Thank you, Lynn Hill. My name's Marcy, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you for asking me to come share at your home group. I've heard all for years, oh, it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in AA. I was like, yeah, whatever. And it is so, especially in a home group, just so nice to be asked to participate. I'm a member of a home group. My home group is the West Hampton Big Book Study. We meet on Mondays at 7:30 at the West Hampton Church in Richmond. And I am very protective of my home group because it's a safe place to bring newcomers so they can see what Alcoholics Anonymous is like. So for me to be asked to participate in your home group is a really big deal because I only imagine you're a little bit as protective as I am of mine. So that is why for me it's such a big deal to be asked to participate. My sobriety date's April 17th, 1995. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. And I also participate in service where we go out to the penitentiary once a month. And there have been times when I went out twice a week, but right now it's once a month. And I also am active in fellowship where it's mandatory fun with other women and Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, that is really hard. In fact, I was talking to one of my dear friends on the way here. She called me and she said, Marcy, or she text messaged me and she said, I'd like to study at your knees in the art of fun. What are you talking about? I call her back because, you know, she plays to my ego. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, one of the things that I just love is your willingness to have fun. And I chuckled because for me, that was practice. And I was raised in a very loving, fun home. And I was raised where, I could tell you story after story after story about how much fun we had growing up. One was my uncle. I was raised by my aunt and uncle. My uncle loved to throw pies in people's faces. And my auntie would make these beautiful pies only to have them wasted. And so that's what she'd get frustrated about. So she started making shell pies, where she just put whipped cream in a shell so he could have something to throw in somebody's face. And so it's interesting that coming from that environment, I had such an awkward time with how do you have fun? I mean, I'd show up for mandatory fun parties, and I was like, what do I do now? When is the activity? What do we do next? And just had such a hard time being spontaneous unless it was planned. So anyway, I can be spontaneous when it's thoroughly planned. I am somebody that came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I actually first came to you when I was 14 years old. My sobriety date, though, is 1995, and at that time I was 20, so to help you with the math, because I'm always very concerned with the math, I'm 36, I'll be 37 a week from tomorrow, which is amazing to me that I'm still alive. I'm very thankful for my AA birthday, but very struck in awe of my belly button birthday. So I came to you 6 years before I got sober, and I really knew I didn't belong here with you. And honestly, I say I came here 6 years before I got sober. What I mean by that is I got into trouble, and it was suggested to me I attend some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I did that. But I never wanted to participate in this way of life. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I got into trouble, when it was a punishment, the courts had me sign a slip, when it was about to be a punishment. But that's I treated Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess, much like not even counseling, but it was another court-appointed option to get out of trouble. And so I didn't ever participate in this way of life or even any activities here. But one thing I did here when I came to meetings was I saw that you were very well-dressed, that you were older, because all of you were over 30, 25, and that's older. Now I'm like really older compared to that way of thinking. But this was my thinking. You had lost homes, you'd lost spouses, or marriages, you'd lost custody of your children, or you're about to lose custody of your children. you've lost careers, and you just lost a tremendous amount. You'd gotten in trouble with the law, you'd gotten DUIs, you'd been in jail, you'd been in the penitentiary. I've never experienced any of that. I've never lost a house because of my drinking. I've never lost a car because of my drinking. I never had any of those things, but I never lost them. And that is the crux of alcoholic thinking, as far as I can tell. That we come here and we say, I'm not an alcoholic because of XYZ, and it's so far removed from our experience that it's impossible that we would ever even walk into that realm. What I mean by that is, since I've been sober, I've talked to a bunch of women that are not alcoholics because they never were homeless. Well, they make more money in one day than I'll make in my entire life, so there's scant chance of their becoming homeless anytime soon. And I knew I didn't belong here because I'd never lost those things. And also, Alcoholics Anonymous was for career-minded individuals, because I heard you talk about drinking your way up the ladder of success. The more I drank, the more successful in my career I became. The more I drank, the better grades I got. I know that's not everyone's experience, but even today, I get so aggravated when I hear that as your experience, because I'm like, that, in fact, Friday night I heard a speaker that was talking about that, and on the inside I'm like, why couldn't have that been me? It was so obvious the way I drank that on my outside absolutely matched that of what most people describe as an alcoholic. I was homeless. I was a punk kid that bathed about every 3 to maybe 6 months, and just didn't take care of anything in my life. And what's great is that doesn't matter. That has nothing to do with my alcoholism. That's not why I'm an alcoholic any more so than you're an alcoholic because you lost a home or a car or a marriage. My alcoholism is, once I start drinking, I have no idea what will happen. None. And what's really tricky for me is there were times when I say I'll have two. I love that. I drank a lot with the thought of having two because it sounds sophisticated and grown up. And I bet if I ever drank again, it'll be, I'm going to have two. That just sounds sophisticated and grown up. So, and there were times when I did have two. And that's what made me looking at whether or not I'm an alcoholic really tricky, was because you said, what I thought I heard you say was alcoholics never drink one or two. They always drink past where they intend. But what you said, and I didn't hear, was we can't predict what's going to happen once we start drinking. There was a time in high school where I drank a six-pack. And I was stone cold sober after that. And then the very next night we went out, I had two shots. I was on the floor in a blackout. Don't remember any of the night. And that was really confusing to me because I thought alcoholics drank a whole bunch, and that's what made them an alcoholic. And that's not my experience. My experience is sometimes I'd have two and I'd be on the ground in a blackout. Sometimes I'd drink past drunk and stone cold sober and I'd never get drunk. And what was aggravating to me about that is there were times when I set out deliberately to get drunk, and I drink past drunk and never get drunk. So I share all of that to say that what I've come to see an alcoholic is somebody that has no idea what's going to happen once I start to drink, and yet it makes sense that if I try something different, it'll work out. I got to stay away from gin. That's what's dangerous, is gin. That's always been dangerous. And when I was like 13 years old, my cousins, they're all from Vermont. And I don't know if it's true with all New Englanders, but with my family, the closer to death you are, the more fun you're having. When we'd go out on a boat and we'd hydroslide or kneeboard, if you didn't hit the water and it felt like glass, you weren't having fun. I mean, we love that kind of fun. I still love that kind of fun. But they were, for weddings and funerals, heavy drinking. and not all of them are alcoholics. So I go to a wedding, and we're drinking very heavily. We're mixing gin and Donald Duck orange juice. And I've never touched Donald Duck orange juice or gin to this day, from that day to this. In fact, I have tried, like, thinking, well, maybe because it's not mixed with gin, I can drink Donald Duck orange juice. That has been sufficient reason for me never to touch that stuff. And I never have gone back, and I've never had this, like, craving to try it again. I'm fine never touching it again. But that wasn't my experience with alcohol. Let me try a different kind. Let me try it a different way. But anyway, that night, my cousin, who I grew up with, so she might as well be my sister, she passed out and she started to get sick and she didn't move her head from her vomit. And so I don't know why, but I woke up and moved her head, and my somehow my aunt woke up as well. We were probably because of the stench, because we were all in the same hotel room, and she was just furious. And I thought, oh my gosh, what's wrong with you? I'm 13 years old, for the love of God. If you've had the life that I had, then you tie one on from time to time, and what's the big deal? And that's the way that I treated all my consequences, was, what's the big deal? And part of my life experiences, the reason I lived with my aunt and uncle is because Child Protective Services had removed me from custody with my parents because of abuse. And so I just stored that one away to use later, and that night was a good time to use that. Well, Mama, I've had a rough life. I mean, I've been abused. And I mean, come on, you would act the same way too. And I understand what they're talking about in our literature when they describe, try to talk to an alcoholic about his drinking, and he'll either laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. My irritated and refuse to talk looks like, I've had a hard life. I've been abused. Of course this is how I'm going to react. I mean, why would you just... And it's, don't pay any attention to what's going on over here, because I've got something else to show you. And I'll use whatever I can find. And I loved to pull at your heartstrings, because then you start crying. You start feeling so bad for me. And maybe you're uncomfortable enough that you'll stop talking to me about my drinking. And I didn't do that. It wasn't premeditated, but it worked, so I continued to use it, and that's good enough for me. My cousin Christopher got clean in Narcotics Anonymous in 1989, and that's when I've had my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. He got into the middle of Narcotics Anonymous. He got into the middle of recovery. He introduced my family to recovery, my aunt and uncle to CODA, which my understanding is it's about the Alcoholics Anonymous equivalent of Al-Anon. So my aunt would say things like, Marcy, you don't want to come home by 11:30? I understand. That's a really tough curfew on a 14-year-old. It can be really difficult. Not a big deal. If you don't come home by that time, I'm going to move your stuff out of this house, because there have been too many times when you don't come home by curfew. Because I would do this thing where I'll be home, and then I'd miss curfew. So 3 or 4 days later, I'd show up thinking that she'd be so worried about me that she wouldn't even think about the fact that I'd been out. Because that's how my thinking is, I might be in trouble, so let me chop off my right arm. So you're more concerned about my injury than you are about my trouble that I'm in. And I understand when we talk about insanity and this lack of proportion, because that's a perfect example of just how improportionate my thinking is. I've missed curfew. I can't possibly go home today or tomorrow or next week or the week after. I'll show up 3 weeks later, and then when I show up, she'll be so happy to see me. It'll be water under the bridge. Or I've gotten to drinking so much, I don't even realize that 2 or 3 weeks have elapsed. That's also happened to me, where I came home and I was just as shocked as she was that I was late for curfew. I mean, I really thought it was the day of, and it was 2 or 3 days later, and I'm like, I don't understand what happened either, but I can't say that to her, because then she'll question me about my drinking. And it's a tough position that we're in. So my stuff got put out, and I put my aunt and an uncle in a position where they have 5 children. They raised my brother and sister and I, so that puts us at 8, and then 2 neighbor kids, so that's a total of 10. And we'd have contests to see who could invite a friend over and that friend stay the longest before my aunt and uncle found out that there was an extra mouth at the table. For what it's worth, that record is 1 week. But it was just a lot of fun. And so there was no locks on the doors because with that many people coming and going, it's just impossible to keep track of keys. I put them in a position where they had to find a way to lock those doors. Because it became really important to know who was coming and who was going. And that was the beginning of what I saw that I did to them. And they didn't hear from me for the next 5 years because I had things to take care of, and they kicked me out of their house. They were only, the lie I told myself was they kicked me out. The only reason that they ever welcomed me in that house was because of the Social Security check they were receiving from the state. They always wanted to separate me from my biological parents, which doesn't make much sense to do that and to collect. But anyway, we'll get to logic maybe here soon. And also, that CPS check is about $200 a month, and if you can raise a child on $200 a month, my hat's off to you. But I had to tell myself these lies so I could make sense of the life that I was living. And I hope that I can repeat this as well as I heard one of my friends say it, that his bottom was when he couldn't tell himself lies fast enough to keep up with how quickly his life was deteriorating. And for me, I had lost everything worthwhile. And I've never met an alcoholic every alcoholic I've ever met that walks down the path of recovery has lost everything worthwhile. Everything. Whether you're sitting in a penitentiary and you're sitting there because it's your second murder, which you don't even remember the first one, let alone the second one, because what happens is you're like me, you take a drink, and you just don't remember much so much. And her experience was she woke up and her babies were dead. And then the next time she woke up and her boyfriend was dead. And she's at the mercy of what the court's telling her. My experience is I woke up and Mama tells me I'm late for curfew. I wake up and the school says you can't come back here. I wake up and my cousin's kicking me out of the 5th apartment because I've gone and I've lived with all of my cousins. And I believe what they're telling me. I mean, I don't have much reason not to believe it, but I don't have any defense either because I thought that I was coming home within curfew. I didn't mean to bring that stuff to school. I didn't think it was still in my book bag. I didn't mean to bring these people over to the house. In fact, I don't even remember inviting them over to the apartment. So I'm just as surprised they're at this apartment, cousin, as you are. So I don't understand why you're asking me to leave, because I'm shocked they're here, and here you are asking me to leave. And so what my bottom looked like is a good friend of mine. I loved drugs, for what it's worth, just as much as I loved anything else that gave me power, whether it was sex or money or drugs. I'll do it until it's at its end, and then and then I might look for another option. And one of my girlfriends was an IV drug user, and so we'd started hanging out, so I'd become one along with her, and she would say stuff like, I'm getting clean. And that meant I'm not using the IV drugs. I'm just going to drink a lot so that way I can come off of this drug long enough to clean up. I loved helping people get clean because I can drink a whole lot during that period. And I really believed I was a drug addict. And where I began to see that I'm not is I liked getting clean more than I liked doing the drug, because when I'm coming off of it, I can drink a whole bunch. I love to get clean, actually. So she told me she's getting clean, and I said, that sounds great. I'll help you. And we get in her car to go down to Florida. And I didn't have a car. That's why I never got a DUI. It's shocking. I did have a bicycle, and I got into a few bicycle accidents that were my fault. But I get into her car because the other thought is, it's a free vacation, I'll go with you. I hadn't left a five-mile radius in probably at least 4 or 5 years. And somewhere along the way, I come to, and she's talking to me and telling me that when she says come clean, she means everything. No alcohol, no drugs, nothing. Because, by the way, drugs are illegal, so probably I'd consider not engaging in that activity, even if we safely can, because that was part of my attraction to Narcotics Anonymous, is you can still drink, I thought. So, and at Alcoholics Anonymous, they just don't drink, but they do drugs. And it was shocking to me to find out that because drugs are illegal, we don't engage in that activity, and also it affects us from our neck up, so we don't engage in that activity. I mean, that was really shocking news for me. So we get down to Florida, and she says, we're getting clean from everything, and I'm shocked, but what am I going to do? I'm halfway there, so we get there and pull up, and one of my favorite stories is the car out front has a bumper sticker that says, taking a trip, not taking a trip, and it's that holographic. And I thought, at least he does hallucinogenics. I love our thinking. And so we go in the house, and that weekend, when I look back, it was a textbook, perfect 12-step call. Had it been a woman, I don't think I would have gotten out of that car. Because there was a man waiting in there, I got out, and I was willing to go in and talk to him. And he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was completely appropriate and completely on the path and centered in service recovery and unity, and talked to me about all of that. And I was sold, hook, line, sinker, the whole thing. Exactly 30 days later, somebody offered me a beer because I was over at his house visiting, and I took it. Didn't even think about it. Just took it. Makes sense? It was as casually as taking a Kool-Aid. In fact, the guy in Florida, Alan, when I told Alan that I drank again, he asked me if it was as casually as drinking a Kool-Aid. And I was shocked he understood that he asked that, because I wouldn't have put those words to it, but that was exactly what happened. I didn't think through the drink because I never, it would be like thinking through the Kool-Aid. I mean, you don't. You just, somebody offers you a cup of tea, you just take it. So this, I didn't think through the drink. I didn't bring the pain and the misery and the devastation of my last drink to my mind. None of that happened. Not because I didn't want to be sober. I desperately wanted to be sober. I was very excited to be here with you. I believe that I took that drink because of a couple of things. I wanted to be here desperately with you, but I didn't want to do what you do, let alone come to all these meetings. And that's the easiest, as far as I can tell, of what we do here. So I hadn't gone to one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't connected with one person in Alcoholics Anonymous besides Alan and Francis, who I went down to Florida with. And I had never even considered being of service and doing something for someone else. Something as simple as showing up early and welcoming somebody else to the meeting, or setting up chairs, or making the coffee, or chairing a meeting, or closing a meeting. None of that. Because I hadn't been here to hear this is what we do. So when somebody offered me a drink, I just took it. And for whatever it's worth, he and I are still very dear friends, and he didn't want me to get drunk. He didn't want that. The best way I can explain it is, I have a dear friend that's allergic to peanuts. And she'll get in my car, and I'll have an open bag of peanuts because I get low blood sugar, so I have to have something to eat. And she'll say, Marcy, are those peanuts? I'll say, yeah, you want some? She's like, no, close the bag, you idiot. What are you doing? I'm allergic. And the next time, we'll be at my house, and I'll say, you hungry? I have some brownies with walnuts in them. I mean, I can't eat nuts. What do you do? I don't have the experience of being allergic to nuts like she is, so it's not as important for me to understand it as it is for her. I guess I knew her for about 7 years before I finally started to really become aware of it. But yet I'd yell and scream when somebody offered me a beer or something because I'm an alcoholic and I told you I was, so why are you trying to get me drunk? And it was an amazing revelation to me when it occurred to me that it's possible they just don't understand. Their life isn't on the line, so they're not as acutely aware of it as I am, and it's just that simple. So I picked up the phone after having this beer, and it was half a beer. What a wimpy way to go out. Half a beer. The other half I poured down the sink, and I don't think I've ever done that before. I cannot remember ever having done that before. I'm the type of woman that keeps my teeth closed, that way I can filter out the cigarette butts. And I poured half a beer down the sink, and that's just, that's not me at all. Don't act like you never did that. I think that should be one of the questions. Have you ever kept your teeth shut so that way you could filter out the cigarette butts while chugging the leftover beers? Then you might be an alcoholic. So I picked up the phone, I called Francis, and I said, Francis, you need to take me to a meeting. Because I knew what you guys did. You dropped everything to help people when they reached out for help. She said, no, I don't. And I know from this experience that once we are on this path, we are safe. And there's no harm that can come. And what I mean by that is I've heard people share experiences where they reached out for help and they were greeted with a much more open arm than I was. And they got drunk. In fact, I have experiences myself where I was greeted with far more welcome arms than what Frances did, and I got drunk. She was doing that just to be a jerk because she wanted to sit at home and watch a movie. And that does not matter, because what matters is I knew I was done, and I knew I was willing to do anything. And I share that because sometimes there's this thought of, well, I hope I don't do something to make them drink again. Not that I'm going to run around intentionally doing that kind of crap, but I know you're safe. And on the receiving end, I know I'm safe, even with the goofy stuff my sponsor's done. And she's done some goofy stuff. I mean, I've known her for 16 years, and she's been my sponsor for 16 years. And she hadn't always been the most sane or the most loving or the most patient woman. But it's okay. It's really fine because we're both on a path. So Frances said, no, I don't. If you really want to go to a meeting, you'll get on your bicycle and you'll ride. And I am so, so, so very glad for that. Because I know I'm sober today as a result of what happened. I don't know if I would be sober today if something different had happened any time along the way. So I got on my bicycle and I rode the 5 or so miles to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I walked in, they gave out the chips to celebrate sobriety at the beginning of the meeting. And they explain the white chip is a desire to stay sober for today, that you honestly want to participate in a different way of life. So I walked up and I picked up a white chip, and then you started clapping. And I wanted to punch you. I was so mad because I knew if you had suffered like I had suffered, you wouldn't be celebrating my pain and my misery. And then people would say, it's the gift of desperation. I'm like, yes, and you gift of desperation. You don't understand what it's like to be me. I was ripped from the loving arms of my mother when I had a young age. That doesn't work. I got something else that might. And I did not feel like I came home. I did not feel like I belonged here. I looked around the room and everybody was clearly older than me like I said, they were 25, if not older. And 20 and 25 is a huge difference. I'm not talking 40 and 45. 20 and 25, you had 4 good years where you could drink with no consequence because you didn't have to hide it. I never had the privilege of taking a legal drink. I'll never know that joy if I stay sober. I mean, that's the kind of... But our minds are amazing. I've sponsored women. I know I don't belong here. I still have a car. Look at my car. It's paid off, and it's a nice car. It's a brand new 9-month-old car. It's fully paid off. I know I don't belong here. I've sponsored women. I know I don't belong here because you've never committed double homicide. I know I don't belong, and on, and it's so important that I remember that alcoholism is not about what my life looks like out here, but what happens when I drink, and then what happens when I try to stop drinking. Am I able to stop drinking on my own? And more importantly, when I am without alcohol for a period of time, what's my life look like? That's when it's really miserable for me, and I'm driven back to drink because I can't stand to be sober. So when I heard people say you don't ever have to drink again, I was like, buddy, you're an idiot, because that's the only thing that ever helped me out. So I pick up this white chip, and I don't feel at home, and I hate these people, and I hate you for congratulating me, and I went to coffee with you after the meeting because I wanted a ride home. And I don't really care why you're here. It doesn't matter, because if the wrong intentions get you here, maybe you'll find something that you relate to, or maybe you'll find you're not an alcoholic and discover what you are and go home, or maybe you'll find you are home and you'll join us. And that's what happened to me, is eventually I found out that I was home. I really believed I was something else, like I shared. I thought that maybe I was a drug addict. And I am very, very glad nobody told me to leave, because I thought I was a drug addict. They said, stick around. Let's find out what you are. Let's walk through the steps together and find out what you are. And in the interim, we ask that you introduce yourself as an alcoholic. You're not a young alcoholic, young woman, maybe drug addict alcoholic. You are an alcoholic. That means that first and foremost, you're an alcoholic. That's the way directions were given to me, that, oh, but I'm young and I'm a female. I don't care that you're a young female. You are an alcoholic, and that means that you listen to how people think, drink, and feel, and that's what you talk about in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in between the meetings, we'll talk about this other stuff and how your child was neglected as a small child, all that other crap we'll talk about outside of the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that woman that did that with me was my sponsor, and I picked my sponsor, really her name, out of a basket. My home group, they did this thing where they said, raise your hand if you can sponsor other women. And she raised her hand, and I picked her. And I honestly, I'm not even sure why I had a home group, except for I think Alan told me to get a home group. And so I just picked a home group. And I lived over in the Fan, and I didn't drive, and my home group was over in the south part of Richmond. It was on the bus line, but it was about an hour bus ride if you take the transfers. And I committed to that home group. And I was there every week, not because I'm some great person. My experience is, when I tell you I'm going to do something, I find a way to get it done. And that's the experience with everyone I've ever walked with. I don't care you don't have a car. I'm probably the worst person to talk to about not having a car, because I know if I told you I had a keg and you could have as much of it as you wanted until your heart's delight, you'd find a freaking way to get your way over here, come hell or high water. So don't tell me about that crap. And so I went over to that meeting every week, and I picked the sponsor out of a hat. We sat down and talked, and I knew I had made a very big mistake. I did not relate to her at all. And you guys talked about finding a sponsor you could relate to. That's what I thought I heard. That's not what you said. What you said was, find a sponsor who's active in all parts of Alcoholics Anonymous, in service, unity, and recovery. I don't know where I got this idea that I needed to have a sponsor I related to, because the kind of people I relate to are thieves, and they're cheats, and they're nasty. And because that's how I was living like an animal. So I sit down at the table with this woman who's dressed, hair's freshly washed, her makeup's done, she's looking good. There's nothing I relate to about her at all. And she starts talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and participating in all parts of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the more she talks, the less I relate. And just like that first meeting I went to, I believe what I heard at that first meeting was hope. I believe that's why I went to coffee afterward, and I believe that's why I went to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I also believe that when I sat down with Valerie and she started describing to me a program by which I could live, which was completely new to me, that I heard hope. And I was willing to go where she went and do what she did. And we started meeting. the first time we met, she was sleeping on her ex-husband's couch, living out of sweet alcoholic luggage, those nice green trash bags. And I was jealous because she had an ex-husband that would let her sleep on his couch, and she had nice things to put in green trash bags. And I am so grateful that she shared with me since that her sponsor, she's going through a really tough time, which I know it's not about our circumstances, but my God, if you're drawn to those kind of circumstances, it'd be a tough time for much of anyone. And her sponsor said, how many women are you working with? And I'm so grateful for that. Maybe she would have sponsored me anyway. I don't know, but I know that it worked out exactly the way it did. And so because of her going through a tough time, she drugged me where she went. And because I didn't know any better, I just went where she went. And it was a blast. We started participating in the steps. She had, read the big book to me and walked me through the steps, helped me look at the fact that maybe I am an alcoholic, but if I'm still not sure, that's fine. We can move on. Let's just move on from where we are. And it was not until I was a year and a half sober and I had started amends that I really understood that I am an alcoholic and I do belong here with you. And I am so glad that she didn't spend a lot of time navel-gazing about that crap. She's like, look, when it talks about this, this idea of we don't know how much we're going to drink once we start drinking, is that your experience? And would just ask me questions after questions after questions. And truly and honestly, although I had had all of those experiences with drinking and being unable to predict what was going to happen, making up my mind never to drink again, and accidentally drinking again time and time again, I really did not believe I was an alcoholic because I just had not lost what you had lost. And I have come to see that we all come to the table with our, as best I can tell, our last man standing differentiator. That I am different from you because of this. And every single person I've ever talked to as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous has it. And mine was, I am too young. I was ripped from the loving arms of my parents at a very young age. And I am just, I'm just too broken. It's not that I'm an alcoholic. I'm just too broken. My brother, my actual older brother, asked me out to lunch. And I said, well, sure. And I had gotten to the point where it occurred to me that the best way to find out if I'm an alcoholic is to drink. And if you are an alcoholic, that is the biggest lie. Because there's no making up my mind to do jack about jack around alcohol. But I didn't know that. So I'd made up my mind that I was going to drink. And I went out to lunch with my brother. And he was pulling the tab. And I'm like, even better. So we sit down to order. And I went to order a Black Russian because that's what I always drank because I was so paranoid that the bartender was watering down my booze with the orange juice or the grapefruit juice or whatever that I was too scared to order that. And it occurred to me, I'm a lady. I ought to consider partaking in a lady drink. Maybe a wine. I look at the wine menu. And the way I judge a good wine is the higher the proof, the better the wine. And they don't list proof on the menu. I believe if they had, I would have ordered whatever the high proof wine was at that time, which should have been an indicator that perhaps I do belong here with you, but I wasn't as aware of my thoughts as I am today. And I'm sure today I'm not as aware of my thoughts as I will be 10 years from now. But anyway, it had just gotten very confusing. I certainly don't ever want to ask somebody what they think is a good suggestion because then I'll look like I don't know what I'm doing, and so I couldn't go down that path. So I ordered a coffee and water out of habit, and I was going to make up my mind around the booze in a minute, and I ordered my lunch, and I ate my lunch, and I walked out of that restaurant. I had made up my mind to drink. I did not change my mind. Nothing happened except for I forgot to drink. Just like so many other times, I had accidentally drank. And that, for me, was when I knew I'm an alcoholic because I am completely powerless over alcohol. I can no more choose to drink than I could prior to my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous choose not to drink. And so I began to work with other women And it was like hitting the jackpot when I sponsored women with a car, because it was nice to go to the laundromat with a car ride. Man, that is sweet. And the grocery store, you know, it's like schlepping a gallon of milk. You have limited space, so you got to put the milk in your backpack or put it on the handlebar, and then your bike's off bounds. It's really tough. I mean, I carry a heavy cross coming to you. And something awakened in me, and what I think it was is that I understood alcoholism, and I understood that it has nothing to do with the amount of money you make or you don't make. It has nothing to do with the car you own or you don't own or any of that other stuff. And we continued to walk through the steps, and I wrote my inventory, and I've had experience where I've written inventory, and different women have come in to hear it that I don't anymore know than I know Adam, and it was fine. I'm okay. I don't really care who hears my inventory, because I know you are me and I am you. I know that you've had the same crap on yours that I've had on mine. If you say you haven't, you're either lying or you haven't come to the truth about it yet. Now, the details might be a little different, because they always are, because we're so unique, but the feelings are always the same. And so when I came to step six, it was the first time I was faced with something that I couldn't just check. Like, yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I know that there is something that can restore me to a place of sane thinking, proportionate thinking. I know that there is a power that's greater than me, and I give my life unto it, unto him, unto her, whatever you want to call it. I call God him, because for me it's easy, and I'm a lazy woman. I don't much care beyond that. I had done my inventory and read it, and I was faced with step six, and I'm like, I don't really understand. And today, the best understanding that I have is, even with all of this and more clarity of who I am, I really do want you to have me so I can better serve you. And then I just simply ask, please, I mean it, have me. I am yours to do with as you want. That means even if I am that nun in South America that never gets booty again, so be it. I really don't want that though, dear God. But so many times my prayers are, this is what I want, but not really all this. And they have a footnote attached to them. And more my prayers are, really, that's fine, I'll go here. It was one of the gals that I sponsor was over at my house today. I went up to Baltimore yesterday and then rode my motorcycle up yesterday and then rode back this morning, met with this gal. My dad was at my house and he was watching my dogs, so we had a changing of the guards. My dad was walking out and telling me all of the updates with the dogs. Poor old man doesn't have grandkids by me, so he gets the dog updates. And then this gal that I sponsor was coming over, and she came over, and I said, all right, well, you don't got to go, but you can't stay here. I got to get ready because I'm going over to Madison, and I don't want to go. She's like, that's what I love, because you're going to get up and go. I'm like, you're right, because if for no other reason, because I don't want you to find out I didn't do it. And that's the magic of sponsorship that I have seen. And so step seven, just God, you really, you can have me. That I trust that the defects that I have that are so glaring are an attraction for someone else because they watch those go away. Not that that gives me permission to act like a jerk, but that I know that you're safe, that even with the harms I've caused you, you're safe. And I go back and I clean them up as I see that I've caused them. And this list, my amends list, felt to me very immense. I have no idea if it really was or really, I don't know. I mean, I had a lot of financial amends, and I have a very large family. And I began to reach out to my family at least once a week. And the first calls with my mama went like this, verbatim. Mama, hi. I'm just calling. Okay. All right, I'll call next week. And then next week, it was so awful. It was really painful. But that there's nothing to talk about because she didn't trust me as well as she shouldn't. And I didn't know her at all. And in fact, I resented what I did know of her. Here's a woman that opened her home to me. My aunt and uncle have 5 children of their own, and they opened their home to my brother and sister and I. And if CPS is stepping in to remove somebody from their home, they're not the most sane or stable child. I can guarantee you that. And I fell into that category. In fact, every single solitary day for 3 years, my older cousins and I got into a fist fight. Cousin chipped my tooth, broke his nose, broke her finger, sprained my wrist, and on and on and on. And my auntie, every single day, would just be beside herself. What do you do with these kids that are fighting like this? And then we'd disappear for weeks, and then we'd show up, and we'd have the dope man with us or whatever else that we'd have with us. And I resent her. I am so arrogant. It just is striking to me. My father, I began to reach out to him, and I hated him, and for what it's worth, for good reason. Who cares? It's still an evil and corroding thread. I mean, even if it is for good reason, it doesn't much matter. And so I began to see that it's possible I was not the daughter that God would have me be. It's possible that stealing is stealing, and when I stole from him, I stole from him. It's possible my father would empty his coins and chuck them into a dish, and we would sit and sort them and roll them, and then we would take a ride up to D.C. and ride around take the metro to D.C. using those coins and ride the Smithsonian, walk around that or whatever. And so I started stealing those coins and going out drinking, because nothing yells class quite like, this is how I'm paying tonight, buddy. How about you drink? And that's how I roll. And so I went back to my father and I said, you know, I stole from you. I stole money from you. He said, I know. And I said, I don't know how to make that right. And I don't know how else I harmed you. He said, honey, I didn't give a damn about the money. And I'm like, well, what can I do? Because I keep a registry. I don't even know what it's called, but when you had a checkbook, you used to have a checks and balances, but I keep a checks and balance sheet in my head of, here's how you did me, so here's how I'm going to do you. And my father gave me some bald spots, concussion, so this is how I'm going to do him. And so for me to go to him and put all of, because who cares? It's an evil and corroding thread. And that's what Valerie said to me over and over. I don't care that he did that. I know he did that. I understand he did that. But what are you going to do about you? And what I found out that I stole from my father was that time that we spent sorting those coins, was that time that we spent riding the metro, was that time that we spent walking around D.C. And what I took from my father was a relationship with his daughter. Simple. My father did the very best he could with what he had. And the fact is, he was a fine father. He just wasn't given a whole lot. And that's okay. Same thing with my mother. My mother either slept through a lot of she's schizophrenic, and she literally would forget she had kids, and which is funny now. In fact, I'll call her sometimes, and she'll talk to me about President Kennedy and what a good president he is. I'm like, woman, who cares? Why not lighten up and have some fun? She called me a few years ago, and she told me she was going to put her dog into an obedience class. She said, your dogs are pretty well behaved, aren't they? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, how do you train them at home, don't you? And I said, I do. She said, well, what do you do? I think I want to start an obedience class. I'm like, forget about it. I said, Mother, what I do with the dogs is we have hot dogs. And I put one end of the hot dog in my mouth, the other end in the dog's mouth, and we eat it until we meet. And I take flaming hoops, and I let the dogs jump through flaming hoops. Just going on and on and on. And then I have this vision of my mother, like, with half her face removed because the dog's biting her, and tires on fire in the backwoods. She's not going to remember it. And lighten up. It's just life. Who cares? I mean, I get
so stressed out because my mother's crazy and you don't understand what it's like. And I was, and one of my really big fears or concerns was nobody understands my mother's crazy and they think it's me. I have to communicate in such a manner that you understand my mother's crazy, because she would do things like pack us up to leave the house because the toilet was flooding. It's improportionate thinking. I understand that kind of talk. I mean, but I would try to tell you, because I didn't want, I can't explain it beyond that, but I just wanted you to understand it was my mother, because I was so nervous that it was me, and maybe I'm the crazy one. That's such an evil thing. It sounds so awful, but schizophrenic or whatever. So anyway, I just started having fun. I mean, what difference does it make? And for me, it's been easier to start my day and end my day in prayer. And then throughout the day, I'm called to prayer when I do that. And that seems to be that the 11th step is the beginning, is the bookends, and the 10th step are the books. And it's just that simple. I've really complicated things, but it really is about if I know that if I am causing you harm, then it's important that I find out what I've done and step back from that. And the big X is if I know I'm doing it and I continue to do it. It's one thing to do it unknowingly, but if I knowingly go out and do it, that's when it's really frightening. I've done that. I got to get married. The longest I'd ever dated anyone was 9 months. And now I'm married like 12 years. It'll be 12 in October, so 11 years. It's just amazing to me. I mean, that man, I put up with a lot from him, and he puts up with a lot from me. And I'm sure he will tell you he puts up with me more from me than I do from him. I beg to differ. No. But we have a good time. Our relationship makes sense to us. And I spent a lot of time asking you what you do in your relationship, because then I was going to go force that in mine, so that way my relationship our relationship makes sense to us. I went up to Baltimore this weekend. He went off to Fredericksburg. It's fine. My father has, it does not make sense to him. And he's talked to me about how it doesn't make sense to him. And that's fine. I'll tell him, listen, old man, that's fine. But I want to ask you something. How's your relationship with your wife working out? And he's not married. Like, sit down, man. But and it's... We have, my father and I can joke with him like that. And I know that when my father is talking to me about my relationship with my husband, it's out of genuine concern. And there's nothing to defend. And there have been some things that he said, and I'm like, you know, well, man, maybe I should take that back into some consideration. And you've taught me how to do that. My relationship with my sponsor has been the longest relationship I've ever been in my entire life. And so I'm very grateful that you've taught me how to be a loving and kind wife, how to be a loving and kind daughter, how to be a loving and kind participant and member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me share.